You ready to get serious about building content sites and building a profitable business online? Welcome to the Niche Website Builders Podcast. We bring you the latest field-tested tips, tricks, and strategies for building a profitable online asset. We interview industry experts, share customer success stories, and reveal our own experiences working on hundreds of sites to inspire and motivate you to make something happen. Let's do this.
Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of the Niche Website Builder Podcast. This week, I'm talking to a great guest, John Dykstra. Many of you will probably already know John. If you've been in the affiliate space for any length of time at all, you've probably come across his great content. He runs an awesome site called Fat Stacks Blog. And if you sign up to his newsletter, he frequently sends out great content. It's really engaging. A couple of times a week. I don't think he has a strict schedule on when he sends out his emails, but they're great. We talked today with John about scaling, so how he's managed to scale his publishing company, essentially. Now, it's not even a website company. It's more of a publishing company. We talk about finding writers, hiring writers, scaling teams, and then we talk a little bit about John's do's and don'ts when setting up a new site. So we look at his public-facing case study website, and we run through a couple of questions about how he set certain things up, which were a little bit surprising to me. So hope you enjoy that, and let's get into this.
This episode is brought to you by Niche Website Builders, an agency dedicated to helping people just like you build profitable content sites. Niche Website Builders are the hands-off content site marketing agency you always wished existed. It's run by content site marketers for content site marketers, and they help both investors and individuals alike build profitable online properties. They provide a fully outsourced approach to content creation, link building, and done-for-you website builds, the same approach they use on their own six-figure portfolios. For example, their content packages come with a proprietary keyword research process, are written by in-house native English speakers, formatted using templates proven to convert, and uploaded to WordPress with affiliate links added so that all you need to do is hit the publish button. Check them out at nichewebsite.builders/show. That's nichewebsite.builders/show and fill out the form to get coupon codes for 10% more content or a 10% discount on links with your first order sent right to your inbox.
Hey, John, welcome to this week's episode. How's things?
Hey, Adam, thanks for having me. Things are good. Yep, no complaints.
How's the snow? Do you have any snow out in Canada at the moment?
Well, I'm sure lots of places in Canada there are snow, but not where we are. We're in Vancouver on the West Coast. It's kind of like Seattle. The mountains have had a lot, though, fortunately.
Nice. I love Canada. I actually, I was over the other side, but I spent 2 years in Ontario. Did a year of my degree there, and then I met a Canadian lady, as you normally do, and then she came back to the UK with me when I finished my degree, and then I went back to Toronto then for another year when I finished my degree, stay with her, which was awesome. I love the place.
Nice, nice.
Yeah, I was trying to move there actually. So we were applying for sponsorship on the spousal visa.
Oh yeah.
And then like literally go right to the end. We broke up, unfortunately. But literally I came back to the UK, and then it was about 5 or 6 weeks after I came back, we had the final like invitation to go to the embassy for the last interview. And I called her up and I was like, hey, you know, I know we're not together anymore, but any chance of doing me a favor? But yeah, it didn't happen. So I had to stay in the UK then, which, yep, is good and bad points.
Yeah. Well, UK is great. Well, I've been to London, that's it, but I sure liked it.
Nice. Well, thanks for being on this week's episode. And before we kind of get into the nuts and bolts of what we want to talk about today, I think it could be interesting to learn a little bit more about your background. Kind of, I don't know if you remember how you made your first dollar online. You know, how did you get started in this online world of making money?
Oh, yeah, well, I used to practice law, and when I was starting out, the internet was, you know, websites for lawyers was just kind of getting rolling. So we decided to do one, and this was suggested this, the blog for SEO way back when. It was totally different back then. But anyway, started blogging and just writing articles about law that I thought prospective clients would be interested in. And it worked really well, actually. And of course, it had the advantage that a lot of lawyers didn't have websites. So the competition was a lot less than it is now. But anyways, it worked really well. But more importantly, I loved it. I loved the whole SEO content writing, blogging, the whole bit, and the fact that it could actually grow a business was mind blowing for me. I thought that was really cool. So, you know, once I went down the old SEO blogging rabbit hole, I stumbled into this whole world of content sites and all of that. So that was my introduction to it. And I just decided to try some outside of the law arena, and that worked. Back then, it was just affiliate marketing that I did. I didn't do any of the display ad stuff. That was several years later. But the affiliate stuff did work out. And took it from there.
Awesome. I mean, in the sites that you've done since then, law being a really high paying niche, have you ever done anything that's back within the law niche? With your background, it would be almost too easy, right?
Law is tricky. I did actually have a law niche site, but it's a little bit tricky because, I mean, the laws here are different in the United States and in Europe and everywhere else. And even within Canada, you've got different laws in different provinces. So it's very regional, which is a bit of a problem. But there are definitely global, like you could take global approaches to it, which I did a little bit of. But I ultimately did sell that site. But in the interim between switching from full-time lawyer to full-time content publisher, I did some lead gen for lawyers, for law firms, primarily through content marketing. And that was good. And I used my own sites for that. And that was a great way to sort of bridge the gap financially between, you know, finally going full-time with content sites. So yeah, I'm quite familiar with the whole law niche, frankly. And yeah, I can't say I would never go back into that niche, but I have no plans to.
Okay, interesting. I mean, it kind of makes sense, especially if you're in Canada and the laws are different to the States and whatnot. How did that transition look when you, obviously you were working for the law firm and then you started dabbling outside, doing your own sites? How did that transition look from being employed to doing this full time? You know, did you get to a certain amount of revenue per month and then think this is safe enough? Or did you drop down to part-time with your job? What did that look like?
Yeah, no, I waited till I built up. This was before kids, so I had a lot more time, although law is a demanding career as well. I actually really liked practicing law, and but eventually I had to choose between the two. But I knew I hadn't needed to wait till I was doing quite well online. I didn't want to jump ship and take for it to be really risky. So I did wait a bit. Initially when I set out with that I didn't really think that far ahead. It just kind of happened, frankly. And so by 2012, I was full time online. But I said, I was still plugged into the legal arena doing the lead gen for various lawyers. So
okay, that makes sense. So you left your job and you were doing this lead gen, and then somehow you got involved in affiliate marketing. What was your, how did you get involved in that? How did you make the transition from lead gen to affiliate marketing?
Well, I just started up some affiliate marketing sites, doing the usual reviews and writing up content and just trying to get affiliate clicks, and it started working pretty well. That is until the first Google Penguin launched or was released or unleashed on the world. I took a pretty big hit then, which was scary, but fortunately I was a little bit diversified, so I made it through that. I continued with lead gen for a number of years beyond that. I often suggest to people, you know, if you really just want to get full-time online, like freelancing is a great way. Essentially, I was freelancing, right? I was doing work for lawyers. I say it was lead gen because they paid me based on results rather than just a straight up monthly retainer or anything like that. But essentially, you know, it's fast cash, right? Like freelancing rather than waiting to building up a content business. So I did that for quite some time. So that actually helped even after the Google Penguin knocked a couple of my affiliate sites down, and rightfully so. I mean, at the time I was choked, but you know, I was doing all the sort of link building stuff that I think a lot of people were doing and that Google really wanted to end. And they did fairly quickly with that update. And then, so I had to reassess and I started a new site after that. And that's grown tremendously since then.
So the Penguin update kind of reshifted your focus from quick wins, quick working on affiliate sites, more to becoming a publisher then. So to push out lots of high quality content. Is that kind of what happened? You decided overnight to try and rebuild the business?
I think like a quick, I wouldn't characterize what I was doing as quick wins before that. I think I would characterize it as basically everybody did it, including a lot of small businesses too. I mean, link building was essentially just blasting out lots of lousy links, and it had worked for years up until that point. And there was never any word that changes were coming down. Like Penguin was this fairly big surprise, right? In hindsight, yeah. Of course, it's not surprising because it still took time. I mean, essentially, like, you know, everybody was doing it. So that's what you had to do for SEO, right? So when that ended, you had to reassess and think about, okay, well, what's the new SEO playing field and environment? And that boiled down to good content. And in the long run, I'm really happy about that. I'm happy about the fact that we don't have to spend 80% of our time trying to game search engines and building lousy links, which is like, it was horrible, lousy, tedious work. And now just get to focus on the content. And I do like that. And that's worked out well for me. So, but yeah, definitely not a quick win either. I mean, that took time as well.
Yeah, for sure. That makes sense. Okay. So your portfolio these days is primarily display ads. So lots of content, display ads. You still do some affiliate marketing, right? But it's very little in comparison to your overall revenue. And I know you've sold some of your sites recently. So huge congratulations on that. I know you listed some with Motion Invest. What's your portfolio looking like currently? Because I haven't seen an income post from you for a while. So I don't quite know what your current sites look like.
Yeah, I'm so behind, man. I've just been the income reports are coming. I'm not bailing on them. They're coming. You know, Christmas came, take time off, and on and on. Yep. Anyways, they're coming. Portfolio right now, I'm focused on two niche sites and fat stacks primarily. I've got a couple small other sites, but I'm not really actively working on them. Just hanging on to them. I don't know. Just they don't really do much. So I went from, I don't want to say it's a large portfolio, but a bigger portfolio of sites to focusing down, because I just really want to focus on the two that I think really have great potential and that I'm interested in. And so the smaller one that's newer, that's an area that surprisingly I'm interested in. And I think there's good potential on that. You know, I even considered like just going back to one site, really, and then Fat Stacks, where I talk about this stuff. But I do kind of like the idea of being a little bit diversified. As a Penguin casualty, it's always nice to just have a bit of a plan B. So that's sort of why I do that and have the second site. Because I got colleagues who have huge, huge sites, but that they have the one site. And that's the focus. And I can't fault that strategy at all, because their sites are awesome and they do really, really well. And I obviously, you know, have one site that generates the lion's share of the revenue with the niche side business. But I really would like to have two just in case.
Just in case. That makes sense. I think that's wise. So one site, which I think you literally just sold Friday, which was up for sale, was Yoga Baron. It looked like a great site, to be fair. And it was making a good chunk of money. I think it's average, like just over $5,000 a month for the last, I don't know how long, for a long time. I was surprised to see the sale price is quite low. I mean, on places like Empire Flippers and other marketplaces, I'm seeing sites as high as sort of 45, 50 times. But I think this one got sold at 21 times. What happened there? Why did you list it? Well, not why did you list it, but why did you think it sold for such a low multiple when it's almost a seller's market right now?
Yeah, you're right. And the other site sold for huge multiples too. And I had originally priced it at a higher multiple, but it didn't go. And it's a slightly different monetization model, largely dependent on a recurring revenue stream from previous subscription software sales as affiliate. And that worked for years and it was a good cash cow, but over COVID and even started before then, the subscription revenue has just like been a slow, slow downward trend. And so I had to be realistic and acknowledge that, I got to price it accordingly if I want to sell it. That's just the reality of it. And I don't begrudge that at all. I could, because I really just want to focus on the fewer sites and be rid of that. I've always believed had I decided to put more time back into that, I could have reversed the trajectory for sure, but it does take a bit of work and I'm busy enough with my other things. So that's what's happened. I think the buyer got a good deal if they like put in the effort that's needed to get that going again. I think COVID was a problem because it was in a niche that catered to local type businesses, which they've taken a huge hit the last year. So, but things are going to change again. So, yeah.
I think the buyer got a great deal, to be fair. I think you're right there. Going through that process of selling a big chunk of your, or a couple of sites, is there anything that you did to kind of pre-sale to increase the value of these sites? Did you follow any kind of quick win plans to make sure that you got the highest value, or were you literally interested in just getting rid of them and focusing in on this new plan of focusing on two sites?
Yeah, no, I did nothing. I just listed them and just hope for the best. The six went, they were smaller sites.
Yeah,
they went for a good valuation very, very quickly, and then the seventh took quite a bit longer. But no, I did nothing. I was just, I don't know. It's hard to be motivated to put any effort in anything you're going to turn around and sell in a month, unless you think there is something you can do that can like instantly increase its value. But there was nothing. I mean, they're just content sites earning with ad revenue.
Cool. And how was the process with Motion Invest? I've not sold through them personally. How did you find that whole process from start to finish?
Oh, they were great. I went with them because, they said that they would take care of pretty much all of it. And I had listed a site years ago with another broker and I just about went nuts, man. Like the amount of like every day I get questions and they wanted info and they wanted this and they wanted that. And I was like, never again am I going to be this involved. If I'm going to sell a site, I want whoever's going to do it. And I'm happy to pay the commission. I don't want to get involved. Like, don't bother me. Here's the access to all the stuff. You provide that if you're willing to do that. And Motion Invest right away said, yeah, we'll do that. We'll be your full service. And they did. And it's made it way easier. I mean, obviously I had to be a little bit involved. There were a few questions here and there, but it was nothing like the previous experience that drove me crazy. So that's why I went with them. I acknowledge that the commission is probably, well, I think it was in line with industry norms. I'm not really sure. This is actually the first time I've actually gone through with selling sites.
Yeah.
So it was all new to me.
Well, if you thought that process was hard, I mean, try selling a site in one of the Facebook groups. It's a million times harder. You get so many questions and tire kickers and
on people. A Facebook group?
Yeah, we actually own a Facebook group, the Niche Website Flippers group. And there are a couple of others as well where people buy and sell sites. So there's no broker involved. There's no commission and they just kind of deal with each other. Typically, it's for smaller sites. But, I've bought and sold sites on there sort of $20,000, $40,000. And you get so many people asking for access to analytics and questions. You can get just people trying to pitch you their own site for sale when you're trying to sell a site. I'm like, no, dude, I'm selling. I'm not buying right now.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for the heads up. I'm not ever doing that.
No, definitely not. All right. Awesome. So, I want to talk a little bit about your strategy because it's pretty unique. I think you're obviously insanely content heavy and very little to no backlinking. Pro tip, which I've seen you mention, which I think is really clever, is how you turn your tables into images. So they're not HTML tables or anything like that. People then, take those images and link back to them, and you haven't got to worry about formatting and all that kind of those headaches that come along with tables. But is there a reason why you don't do any backlinking? Is it because of the whole experience with Penguin in the past, and you were kind of a little bit burned from it, and you just think, well, you know, I'm going to do everything by the book now, and Google says no backlinking, so that's what you did? Or how did you come up with this process? Yeah.
That's definitely a big part of it, for sure. I mean, that was sort of my driving MO when I launched what is now my biggest niche site way back. And that wasn't shortly after Penguin, but it was about a year and a half after. And I was like, all right, I'm going to do this right. I'm going to think long term, and I want to build up this massive site that essentially becomes a business unto itself. And so, yeah, that was my strategy. And, you know, I fumbled around with the keyword research stuff, but eventually I fell in the stride and it worked really, really well. And so at this point, why would I risk it? I mean, that would be insane. Like, there's just no need. Like, I could go out and buy 100 links or build 100 links or whatever, but I mean, what I'm doing is working so well. Why would I do that? Why would I increase the risk even 1%? It's just not necessary. And that's not to say the site is not immune to risk, right? I mean, all sites are. You can do everything right and still have take a hit on an update. In fact, this site's had its ups and downs. It's had downs for sure. I mean, there have been updates down 25%. It's just the way it goes. It doesn't mean that the site's bad or anything. It's just something got tweaked with the algo and it just gets pushed down a little bit for a lot of searches. So, but then, you know, maybe two updates later, it rebounds, and that's how it's been in 7 years. So yeah, I guess initially it was a response to Penguin, but now it's sort of like, well, it works without doing it. And so I can either invest, you know, $3,000 a month in the links or in the content. Both will work. I'll just choose content and choose the different keyword strategy rather than, so that's what I've done. If I were doing all affiliate marketing and I wanted to rank for super lucrative keywords, and I like that idea more, yeah, I would build links. And actually, I think, you know, with future sites and smaller sites, I have no problem. I probably will build links because I can afford to take a bigger risk on another site right now, right? If it goes bad, I still have a site that's earning well, so I can take bigger risks with other sites. So yeah, it's not like I've got an ethical issue with it or anything like that. It's just business decision.
It's a risk factor. I think we've talked recently about you potentially using one of our Shotgun Skyscraper packages. Is that going to be for one of your smaller sites, I'm assuming, then?
Yes, that's correct. Okay. Yeah, no, I'm excited about it. I've checked you guys out and it looks good. And I'm excited to deploy that. I think of any methods or approaches, it looks like a reasonable approach. I mean, you know, you're putting out awesome article and just promoting that article essentially, yeah, to get attention to it in links. And so that sits well with me. I'm excited to see how that can help the site for sure.
Awesome. One thing which you mentioned there, which I think was interesting, and it's super relevant considering we just had an update a couple of weeks back, you know. When these updates happen and you say, you know, there's been updates where you've lost a quarter of your traffic, what do you do? I mean, I see in the Facebook groups, literally the day after an update, someone has lost traffic and they're trying to pinpoint what happened and what can they fix. Do you take an approach where you try and figure out what happened, or are you just confident that the site is, you know, you've built a good quality site and over time it's going to come back? Like, how do you
handle
that?
That's a good question. No, I don't. I mean, I'm not like other people who talk about this stuff in that they, I don't know, they'll analyze maybe because they do client work, they've got, you know, 200, 300 websites at their disposal and they can analyze and maybe look for patterns. I have one site. So there's no way I'm able to come to some conclusion and be able to say, oh, well, this is why. I can't do that, right? So, I mean, like a lot of people, I wait to see what people who do analyze, let's say 300 websites, and come up with their best guess as to what's going on here.
Yeah.
And then I'll take a look at my site and I'll be like, oh, okay, well, you know, I can't really say I've ever actually taken any serious action after it, but I've cooled on affiliate links intentionally from the get-go. I don't do a lot of affiliate marketing, and the bit I do, it's not that aggressive. Part of me tends to think that I could be out to lunch, but I just think it's safer to err on the side of fewer affiliate links throughout the entire site, and especially affiliate oriented content. It's not that I don't do it. I do it, but it in relate, you know, the ratio of that to just general content is very low. So that would be one thing. I've cooled it in the last year on ads too. I have now actually asked AdThrive to reduce the number of ads by 50%.
Okay.
And I think I've taken a very small revenue hit on that, but not much. Definitely the user experience has improved dramatically. So I think not only am I always looking at improving the quality of the content on the site, and but I'm also looking at the overall user experience. And I think if you, you know, faster site, I've invested a lot into speeding up the site speed. I am reducing the number of ads on the site, and I'm constantly updating older content. So I'm doing all these things to make it a better and better site. And I think that's all I can do. And I think that puts me in a better defensive position to guard against losing traffic from updates. But again, it could happen. And if it, you know, it does happen, and I'm sure it will happen, all I can do is trust in the strategy. And if I did make a glaring mistake, then I got to go back and fix it.
Makes sense. Makes perfect sense. You mentioned there that you asked AdThrive to reduce the ads in half, but then you haven't. My initial thinking would be you'd lose half of the revenue, but that doesn't sound like it's been the case. How does that work? How did they just remove certain ads that maybe weren't paying very well in the past, and that's why you only saw a little drop in income?
Yeah, what I do is the 50% reduction pertains to in-content ads, right? So basically, like networks like AdThrive will programmatically put ads every X number of pixels down your. So if you have a really long article, more ads are going to just show up just because that's how it's programmed. So what I ask them to do is just let's cut that down to 50%, or else add 50% more space between the ads. So
yeah,
a better user experience. The above the fold's the same. And the way I look at it is the in-content ads, I mean, they do add up in the revenue, but your big money is going to be your stickies and your above the fold ads. I mean, in fact, I'm sure, I don't know how much I would lose, but I could probably remove all in-content ads, and I don't think it'd be a huge difference. In fact, that's probably my next move to further improve user experience. I'm not saying I'm doing that tomorrow, but
yeah,
if traffic keeps going up and revenue keeps going up, I want to keep improving the user experience. I think that's really important.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I've literally been doing something opposite recently. It sounds like I'm maybe going down the wrong hole here. So I've been testing recently about adding more images and more content, mainly in the form of FAQs to existing pages, in the hope of adding more ad placements to increase my page RPM. So it's bad for user experience because there's more adverts there. But in a way, I'm trying to combat that by adding more useful information. So I'm not just having the, you know, I'm with Mediavine on that one. I'm not just having them add more adverts per pixel. I'm trying to add more useful content, so there's more space to add for them to show more adverts. And I mean, I've only been testing this literally for like 4 weeks now. And in doing that and updating my top 20 pages, I've seen a bump in overall RPMs of almost $10 now for the site. So it's working, but to the detriment of user experience. The jury's out on that yet.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so. I mean, it's not like you're not increasing the content length and just saying let's double the ads. You're increasing by increasing the digital real estate. Yeah. And I've often written about the fact that, you know, adding in content and images and tables and all of that to increase your digital real estate while being good content is a good strategy. You will add another ad or two to your article, as would I. It's not like I've cut them all out. It's just, yeah, they're just spaced up. And I think it's a great strategy.
Awesome. Well, thank you. Yeah, I'm glad that you were on the same page on that then. I wasn't doing the total opposite of what you were doing. Cool. Okay. Can you give us, so you're obviously a content publishing machine at the moment. It's a well-oiled machine. Can you give us kind of like an overview or like a bird's eye view of what that content operation looks like? I've broken it down into three areas we can cover in more depth, but just from the top level, how many words of content are you currently produce in a month at the moment, or have you been producing for your portfolio?
I don't know. I don't really track it. I Every article is different, and I've got a system in place now where I actually leave the word count to the writers rather than myself. I used to guesstimate word count for an article, and then they would usually come in right around there. Now I leave it to the writers. They have access to MarketMuse, and they use MarketMuse and the topics to determine what the word count should be. Definitely word count per article is going up based on that, but I think the content's even better than it ever been. And so, I honestly don't even check. I basically have a budget for content, and I have a huge list of article topics in a shared spreadsheet. And when the budget's used up in the month, that's it. And wait till the next month and fire it up again.
Okay.
So I'm not really I don't know. I haven't added it up.
Yeah.
In probably 6 months.
What's roughly your budget every month then for content?
Oh, between 8,000 and 10,000, sometimes 15.
Yeah.
Kind of varies. Depends on other things that I'm doing. If I had to hazard guess, probably like between 50,000 and 100,000 words, maybe more.
That makes about sense. Yeah. Okay.
You'll see an overarching theme that I actually don't really pay attention to a whole lot of these sort of things in anything. Like, I don't really track much. I just sort of eyeball everything because I just don't want to take the time to do it. I'd rather write a great article. I have a lot more fun writing. I'd rather spend my day writing a fun article for any one of my sites than sit there and comb through this stuff. As long as numbers are moving in the right direction, I have no reason to really look. If problems arise, then I'll look under the hood. But unfortunately, it's been great for a long time, so I haven't had to bother looking.
I wish I knew this before the interview, because I'm the total opposite. I'm totally data-driven, and most of my questions are based around how do you track and measure stuff. So it's an interesting approach. It's totally different to the way I approach stuff. Okay, so you're doing a good chunk of content every month. Along with that is a good chunk of keyword research then that you have to be doing every month. Are you still doing all of the content research? Have you managed to outsource that successfully? What does that look like? And I mean, I know when I had a bigger portfolio than I currently do, I was almost always the bottleneck, whether that's keyword research or, formatting and uploading. Just curious to hear, how you handle the keyword research, and if there's a bottleneck, is it you, or how do you overcome that?
I still do it. That's actually a good point. By reducing the number of sites I had, that saved me quite a bit on keyword research. I find keyword research, the more you focus and the more you work on a particular site, the easier the keyword research gets, because you really get into it. So if you're trying to do keyword research for 15 websites, you're never really going to really dig down deep into the niche for all 15, like you would if you're focused on two sites. And because it's just, I'm publishing, my budget per site is up way higher than it was, because now it's just two sites, which means I need to come up with more topics every month. I don't want to spend a full week on it. I want to spend a handful of hours, and that's it. So I really just drill in big and fast. And when I find a keyword phrase, this is huge. This has saved me so much time. Not only that, it's created a lot of great content. But when I find a keyword phrase, a seed phrase that can work for a lot of different articles on the same site in the same niche, I will basically like put them all on the list, like right off the bat. And sometimes it's like, I just added 200 articles to one of my spreadsheets for a site, 200 in one go. And it didn't take me long to come up with that. And so now I'm set for, I don't have to do keyword research for that one for months. So that's what I do. But I do it. And I know what it's like to be the bottleneck. I haven't been for a while, especially since I sold my sites. And I have tried to have other people do it. But, at the end of the day, I do the best job, at least for my sites. So I still do it. And it's not a huge ask. I think in a few hours, I can do the keyword research each month for two sites. So,
yeah, I find the keyword research, even if it's systemized, there's still an art there, right? Like there's still a bit of a gut feel about when you're doing it. So even you can use all the data you want, but there's still that art of keyword research that is hard to teach.
It really is. And it's there is an art to it. And it's this, you know, I just fire up Ahrefs and I just play with filters and I just play around and I scroll and I scroll and I scroll and I scroll. And I find, like, you know, too many people just do a really superficial process of it. And, you know, they'll just put in a seed keyword and then they'll just leave it at that. But it's almost like I'll put in seed keyword. I'll look for related keywords. Then I'll put that back in. And it's sort of like just drilling or peeling the onion, trying to just find, looking for those really great keywords that other people aren't doing with these, you know, sometimes it has good search volume, sometimes it doesn't, but you just know it's sort of like, wow, that is going to be a great addition to the website, you know? And I get excited finding these things too. And maybe that's what drives me. Maybe that's why it's worked. I don't know, but yeah. It's hard to train.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
People, you know, until they have their own site and they're dependent on their ability to do it as well. Yeah. That's when you're going to up your game, right?
Yeah. Do you always start with the seed keyword and try and drill down, or do you ever look at competitors and see what they're doing for inspiration and ideas, or are you always trying to find like just words and phrases and go from there?
Oh man, I do so many different starting methods. Like, it's crazy. Like, I've come up with a lot of different approaches, and you know, it's almost sort of like a meandering thing that every session is different. I don't have a, like I'll just, I don't know. It just sort of just kind of goes, and I just keep going and going and stumble on different things. And I try not to figure it all out. All I need, what I try to figure out is what's next month's set of articles. That's all I need, right? Yeah. I just got to find good ones. I don't need to have the whole website figured out now, because I never will. Like, if you would have told me 5 years ago I'd have 6,000 articles on a website, I wouldn't believe that, but now I do. And can I come up with another 6,000 topics? Yeah, I can, but I'm not going to figure it out today. So it just kind of happens organically.
Yeah, that makes sense. Just a quick, a sub question, like totally irrelevant, but you mentioned that you have like 6,000 articles, and you know, over time, you probably want to add another 6,000. Does there come a time when WordPress no longer handles that much content, or can WordPress scale that much?
Oh yeah, no, I've talked to people of like 80,000 articles with WordPress. No, that's not a problem. It's hosting. You got to make sure you got a pretty good host, I think, at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Okay. So you're still doing the keyword research. You're no longer the bottleneck because you've kind of sold your sites, and you can do this a couple of months in advance. When it comes to the content creation, am I right in thinking that you've got, you know, some of your own in-house writers, but you also then outsource a big chunk of that?
Correct. Yeah. I'm doing both right now. It's really good. Very happy with the arrangement.
And how does that work? How do you find, well, first of all, how did you find good quality in-house writers? Because, I mean, before
Pro Blogger job board, by far. Like, oh, man, that's awesome. Worth every nickel to advertise.
Okay, interesting. And do you test them first? Like, do you give them a sample blog titles first and kind of vet them, or are they good to go off the bat there?
Hiring is a total gamble. You never know. Basically, one thing about Pro Blogger job board for running jobs, anyways, you're going to get like between 40 and 60 applicants, which is fantastic, unless you're like offering like no money. And then I'll create a short list. I'll ask them in the application, just send me some links to some work you've done and tell me how much you're looking for to earn. I don't post a rate. I ask them to state their rate. So I can create a pretty good short list from those two criteria quickly. And then maybe I'll have 10 or 5, and then I'll just ask them, I'll pay them to write like 3 to 5 articles.
Yeah.
And I just ask them to let me know, you know, send it in and I'll take a look at it, and then I'll make the decision there. But it's really hard at that point. Like when you basically filter down to like 5 to 10 writers, they're almost all going to be able to do a great job. It's really hard to choose. I don't really know. Another tip, if you really want to save yourself, I hate hiring. I don't like doing it. I certainly can't stand training. Hire one really good person, good writer, and then the next time you have to hire and train, then ask them to do it. That's what I do. So I don't really do it much anymore because I hate the process. And it's a gamble. I mean, I can't train someone on how to hire. I'd just be like, do your best. Like, it's,
yeah,
you never know.
And are you always looking for native English speakers there, or it doesn't really matter as long as they can write good content?
Oh no, I'm pretty particular, and I can tell pretty fast. I do ask for that.
Okay,
I can sense it. I do read the stuff they submit. In fact, I make a big decision just on the introductory email that they send me.
Yeah,
and I can usually tell, like, if it's just a little bit off, I know, and I wouldn't be interested.
Okay, and then when you give these article titles out, you mentioned a big master spreadsheet. Are you using that for your writers as well, or do you use like Asana or Monday, or is everything just still controlled off a spreadsheet for you?
So off Google Sheets, everything. Google Sheets and Apple Notes runs my entire business.
Have you ever tried software tools? Like, have you ever tried Monday or?
Oh, yeah, I can't stand them, man. I don't like these. Those are transaction costs. Anything like that doesn't get content out the door, I'm not interested in doing it. Like, I tried them all, actually. I think I did demos of all of them.
Yeah.
I even spent some time setting up ClickUp, and it was like, I just spent half my day on this, just figuring out like inputting stuff in fields. And it's like, I don't have time for this. And then I asked my, one of my VAs who is been with me for years, and like she manages the other VAs, I said, here, you know, if this helps you with your team, I'm happy to pay for it. She like used it for an hour. She said, there's no way that is, I just can't stand this stuff. Like, we're good with email, Apple Notes, and Google Sheets, and that's all we need. Like, I just like to keep things as simple as absolutely possible.
I'm
big on that. I talk about that a lot. Like, just don't complicate this stuff. Just gets really complicated. I'm not an 800 person company, right? I mean, we're pretty small. It's just not necessary.
Makes sense. Yeah. No, I was just interested. I watched a video. On YouTube last night of a blogger that was using like a, I can't even remember what piece of software she was using, but it was something like this. And it was literally her own content creation, and she had this elaborate board setup and all color coordinates. And I was just thinking, how long has it taken you to do that, and why? Like, why do you need that if it's just you? But
that sort of stuff. I've never, you know, fallen prey to getting distracted with any of that stuff. I don't like using it, fortunately. I imagine if I got a kick out of organizing and like I'm a disorganized nightmare. All right. Like, that's the cost. If you can't accept being like totally disorganized, then by all means take the time to do that. But like, I'm just a mess. Like, I don't organize anything.
No.
So that's the cost, but I don't mind. I like it like that.
Well, it's working for you. So you're doing something.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you handle the keyword research, all of the content's outsourced, and then formatting and uploading. Like, these are the three major pain points we always kind of find. Who's doing that for you? You mentioned a VA there. You've got a team of VAs who do the formatting and uploading.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's essentially what they do. That and interlinking.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, I mean, when you break down a publishing business, it's just those three things, right? Keyword research, content, and formatting and uploading. People, you can try and complicate it, but it's just in its basic form, just those three things.
That's all it is, and I 100% agree, and that's what I focus on.
Awesome. Okay. One thing which I kind of want to touch upon, because I'm trying to get into this myself, and I'm an analytical person, I struggle with this, but it's the concept of zero search volume keywords. And I know it's something that you do. I mean, I really struggle with getting my head around it, just because, you know, I like the data, I like looking at it. And I'm coming around because I've been testing, and I can see the benefits of it, and I can see it working. But you've been doing this for a long time. I just want to get your take on, you know, why do you like it?
First off, not every keyword I target is zero. Right? Okay. I mean, yes, I have gone after keywords that are zero, but I mean, that's not my goal. I'm not looking for the zero. I'm looking for as high a search volume as possible, but it's still easy to rank. That's the goal. But sometimes, you know, it's part of a bigger series of articles. And if it's zero, it's zero. If it makes sense that for the website and it makes sense for a series of articles that I'm publishing, and I always do try to publish in series, yeah. I'll do it. And more often than not, I'll end up getting traffic to it, which means zero is not accurate. There's more traffic to be had than is reported. What's important is that there's actually search behind it. So if it registers as a keyword that gets the 0 to 10 in Ahrefs, there's actually search there. How accurate the 0 to 10 is? Generally, it's reporting on the low side. Yeah. Does this mean I get traffic to every article I publish? No, I publish stuff that doesn't work either. I publish some stuff that gets way more traffic than I thought, and then everywhere in between. It's a numbers game. But if I'm doing an article series of 12 articles and three of them are 0 reported monthly searches, I'll include them because they help out with the overall article series.
Makes sense. So it's relevance first, and then any traffic is a bonus almost on top then.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's other things to look at too, because there's seed keywords within the long keyword. Now, I've ranked for seed keywords. It takes a long time. Okay. And with never intention within a longer keyword. And then the traffic's like massive, and that's huge, right? I wouldn't set out and do that with intention to do that, but it can happen. And when that happens, that's like a huge, huge win. And then there's obviously all sorts of keywords within the article itself that are just like accidental rankings. You know, when you write a 3,000 word article, there's a lot of keywords in there.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that. I've been doing a lot with people also asked and scraping kind of questions that Google think are coming next recently. And like the other day, I pulled out 650 questions from the people also asked box all around a specific topic. And then I run them through Ahrefs. And Ahrefs only had 60 of them in the database. Like it didn't have any data on the others. And I was thinking, wow, that's a golden opportunity. There's about 500 keywords there that people would never even think about, because if they were just using Ahrefs or SEMrush for their keyword research. So my initial tests show that there is actual search volume behind those, but it blows my mind that I've never thought of this before. I've always gone off these tools, and if it's not in the tool in my mind, then it kind of never was there before. But this has just opened up another whole world of what's possible at the moment.
Yeah, it's awesome. I mean, it's so much. I mean, it's like you just have to pick and choose. And
okay. One question that I see guests asked a lot, like especially in our Facebook groups, and I think you're well positioned to answer this, is how many sites do you think you can handle yourself without outsourcing all of the above? So everything we've talked about, I think people get to a certain point, they think, I need to start outsourcing now. What is that? Should they start looking to outsource on their first site? Should they get to a few sites? And, you know, is there a magic formula for that?
Oh, I think as soon as you can, start outsourcing. I mean, why not? Like, I still write for my niche sites. Not every day, all day, but I still do it. But that doesn't mean I can't, like, hire some writers to help out. Yeah. No, I would advise, I mean, don't go into debt to outsource. Don't like be putting money on a credit card you can't pay off. That doesn't make any sense. But, you know, there's a number of situations, right? If you have a full-time job and you're doing this and you don't have a lot of time to do it, but you do have a pretty good paying job and you've got some extra money you can invest, you could look at it as an investment, right? So like, just like you would any sort of moonlighting gig you might start up. And so you outsource. Or if you are full-time on this and you're starting to grow and you have extra money, probably worth reinvesting in outsourcing. At least I would, to grow faster. I mean, you know, as soon as you can.
Awesome. Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I think that's a good answer. The next thing I want to talk about is cannibalization, because when you're publishing as much content as you are and you know, 6,000 plus articles on the site, there's going to be some kind of overlap there. And another question we get asked a lot is, how do you decide what's a standalone article versus what can be grouped together as a subheading of another piece? And I've pulled out your ice cream topic that you sent out in an email, I don't know, months back, but I like that. And Like, for example, you've got ice cream recipes, the history of ice cream brands, ice cream versus sorbet, best vegan ice cream. Like, if you keep going on that list, sooner or later, you're going to be able to group some of these headings together. Like, do you just do a new article for them all, or do you try and group them together with, you know, this is the main title and then these are the subheadings? How do you determine that?
Yeah, there's no real formulaic way to do this. If there's a half decent search volume for it, I'll put it as a standalone article. But let's say you've got 10 of them and they're all like the 0 to 10 or 10 to 20 a month. Sometimes they're going to be standalone. Then I would do my best to decipher what the actual search intent would be. Okay, so if the intent is that somebody's really looking for a standalone article, I will. And another good way to try to figure this out is see how Google's treating it already. Okay, so if you put in the keyword in and you'll take a look and see, well, let's say the versus article you mentioned, versus sorbet, right?
Yeah.
Is Google ranking articles specifically ice cream versus sorbet, or is it more as part of a larger article? So you can see how Google treats it. So I kind of just do my best to figure it out from those methods. Again, I'm sure I often guess wrong. I might as well, you could just flip a coin sometimes too, but I would say far more often than not, I err on to create a new article for it.
Yeah, no.
That'd probably be the, like 80% of the time it's a new article.
Okay, interesting. Now,
the other thing that you can do that I often do is if let's say I've got a big long article on ice cream and then I'm doing the versus sorbet, what I can do is I can reference the versus, you know, maybe in the big article about ice cream, you know, I've got ice cream versus sorbet versus gelato versus frozen yogurt. I could then reference it quickly in there, but then link out to the more lengthier discussion.
Yeah. Do you do that manually, or do you use a tool like Link Whisper to help you with that?
Oh, in that example, that would be manual because I'm sort of, you know, creating this linking situation within the two, right? So I might do one or two sentences referencing ice cream versus sorbet, and I'll link out to the long article. Now, if it turns out the ice cream versus sorbet, the best I could come up with is 150 or 200 words, then I don't think I would do a standalone. I think I would just put that in a really relevant, larger, broader article. So there's that factor as well. I do use Link Whisper. I like Link Whisper a lot. I think it's a really great, clever, and it works really well software for any linking, but I still do manual. It doesn't, you know, I find Link Whisper is great for, you know, you publish your article and you just want to, you know, quickly link out to other articles that are relevant and inbound link from other articles that are relevant on your site quickly because it basically does it for you. But that doesn't mean I still don't do my strategic manual linking as well at the same time. There's still place for that. That's how I use Link Whisper, but it's a combination.
Okay. You kind of mentioned this earlier, but and you just mentioned it again there in terms of your content length. Like I think you said you let your writers determine the content length. Have you given them specific instructions on how they should come up with that? Or is it simply, you know, how answer ice cream versus sorbet in, you know, as many words as you need, but not including any of the fluff, and just let me know what it comes out to?
I use Market Muse, actually. I have every writer access Market Muse and input the topics, and that'll suggest an article or a word count. And that's what we go by. Is it perfect? No, not by any stretch, but it's better than nothing. It's better than me guessing.
Cool. Okay. And then before we finish, I want to touch on two other things. So one is about ad networks, and then I want to talk a little bit about your case study site, CycleBaron. But I mean, and this is the other question we get asked a ton of is, what's the difference between all these ad networks? There's AdSense, there's Zoic, AdThrive, Monumentum. Like, you've used them all and tested them all. There's got to be pros and cons to all of them. What's your take on this landscape?
Well, my favorite's AdThrive. That's why I'm using them now. So yeah. I'm fortunate to get in. Not easy to get in. If you can get in, go. I've never used Mediavine. I've heard nothing but excellent things about them. So, but I don't know. I've never used them. AdThrive. I applied to both of them at the same time, and AdThrive happened to approve me faster. So that's there. I go. So before that, I used Ezoic. I think Ezoic is awesome. I think anybody who's qualifies for their fairly low threshold of page views per month should jump in. You got 9 times out of 10, you're going to make more money than just using AdSense. So yeah, definitely want to get into Ezoic. Once you can move into AdThrive or Mediavine, you got to make the call whether it's worth going. If for me, it was worth it, but you know, Ezoic can be very good. I know a lot of big publishers stick with Ezoic. I think maybe they've even tested it and Ezoic worked out to be better. So you never really know. In terms of should you just use AdSense, 5 years ago, yeah, I think that was okay. I really can't imagine you're going to make more money with AdSense than you would with Ezoic or Monumetric. I just don't see it happening. But if you do, I mean, by all means, one nice thing with Ezoic is you can split test all this stuff. You can split test Ezoic ads with, which is just other ad networks. And actually, I don't know where all the stuff comes from, but they provide the platform for it. And then you can see if AdSense makes more. And, you know, so Ezoic's really cool that way. Unfortunately, Ezoic, and I think it's more AdThrive, you can't split test AdThrive and Ezoic. I really wish you could. I think that would be really cool to see. Not just for more revenue, but to actually see what earns more. But unfortunately, that's not possible. So yeah, I mean, that's been my process really over the years. Get in with Ezoic as soon as you can if you're starting out, and then, you know.
Do you think it's even worth having AdSense these days, or should you literally just wait until you've got enough traffic for Ezoic? I mean, should you just literally just skip AdSense altogether, do you think?
Yes. It depends if it's easy. If you get approved, yeah. If then I think it's worth putting ads on. And here's why. That 30 cents a day you might make is really motivating because it's working, right? It's not going to make you rich. But to show that, hey, wow, I'm actually making money with a website is so, so cool. Like it still blows my mind when I think about it. And so, yeah, for that reason alone, I think it's worth doing.
Yeah, I never thought about it from that point, but now you've mentioned it, the excitement that we get from a client when, you know, we've built them a site and in a couple of months, then they start seeing their first affiliate commission come in, like that's golden, especially if it's their first time. So I've never thought about it that. I've always told people to skip AdSense, but that's different. I like that. I like that way of thinking about it.
Yeah, I wouldn't get hung up if you don't get approved. Like that's not the end of the world. A lot of newer sites don't. It's not a reflection on the quality of your site or your articles or you. But if you're in and you can just crank out some ad code and put on a site, for me, it's highly motivating. It's like if I start a new site, like even the smaller sites I sold, I mean, when they were getting to $5, $6 a day, like that's great. I mean, out of thin air, you create this thing that generates $5 a day. Like it's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, good. All right. So the last thing I want to talk to you about is Cycle Baron. So this is your kind of public facing website where you put up a site and it's kind of showing people almost what you do really on a much smaller scale. But there are a couple of things on there that I just want to highlight just to get your take on them. And I'm assuming it's because you haven't had time, but there's things like there's no header navigation on there. there's no category setup. Everything is set to like all uncategorized. There's no about us page. I'm assuming that you don't, this isn't standard across your other sites, right? Like you set up.
Most of the new sites it is. Yeah. I don't do categories or tags until I'm several hundred in. Because in the past, I've constantly just changed them and changed my mind what I'm doing. I don't really know where a site's going to go. So the categories and tags, that's pretty standard for a site that size. I just don't bother. In which case, I end up with no navigation except for a home link, right? Because where am I going to? I mean, I suppose I could link to some specific articles if I wanted. The only thing where I would probably just need some updating on there, maybe a little bit better on the navigation. Maybe I would link to like a larger article, but no, I mean, that's how I grow. You don't have to do what I do, right? Like don't, if anybody is listening or watching this and you think it's crazy, I mean, like, it's not like you should not have categories or tags. I'm not saying it's going to hurt your site. I'm just saying, you know, I just don't really know what direction the site's going to go. That site sort of started off initially as I just had a lot of questions about people wanted to just see how I set up my site. So I just sort of set that up. I wasn't even going to have any content on there, but then that looked really dumb. So it was really more of a visual example rather than this niche case study that I intended to grow a lot. It may. I mean, it does get traffic now, but I'm not really sure. I set it up more as just a visual example. What happens to it? I don't know.
Cool. Well, I guess these next kind of questions you've already answered there in terms of this isn't fully set up, but I want to get your take on like ether expertise, authority, and trust. Do you put a lot of effort into that in terms of your about this page and the authors and the bios and, you know, to the linking out to, do they have social media profiles? Do you do any of that?
Yeah, I do. My biggest niche site, I pay particular attention to, like my about page is really good. I've profiled the writers. I've got editor and partners that we've partnered with over the years that are professionals in the niche, and then awards and all of these things. So that's a really built out about page to bolster the credibility. So I think there's a lot to that. But until I can do all that for a newer site, I don't just make up a whole bunch of stuff and throw it on there. You know, I don't think it's going to be like, unless you're in a niche that where that's particularly sensitive, like health or personal finance, where that's really important. Like if I did personal finance, which I think I probably could legitimately with a business degree and law degree, think I could write intelligibly about that and pass muster credibility wise. I'm not sure. It's just, I'm not that interested in it. But if I were to do that, I would right out of the gates do a really in-depth about page and with all the contact info and all that. But in terms of social media, I only do social media where it actually makes sense for the particular niche site. Pinterest is a maybe. Facebook usually always, yeah. Instagram, not really. I haven't really gotten into that. So, I mean, it only if it makes sense on the social media stuff. And in terms of contact, I do put my address on these things. Even a phone number. Recently, Facebook has been requiring businesses to verify their phone number and address and location and all that. And it's not an easy process. No. So I had to go get a new phone number, a business phone number, which I've never had before, but that was just for Facebook. They rejected my personal number, which
that's crazy.
Yeah. So I had to go get a whole new cell phone plan just for Facebook. But, you know, I do enough business with Facebook that it's worth it. So I did it.
Yeah. Okay. And then schema, do you use any kind of schema on your site?
I do. Well, I use Yoast plugin, which gives you your basic schema stuff. So it says, I don't know, to take the plugin for its word. But I do mostly FAQ, some how to, and I do some recipes. I'll do a recipe schema. So where there's a review schema with a review plugin. So yeah, I do when it's not like I set out to only do articles where I have schema opportunities, but if the type of article fits a schema, I'll input that in. I think that's a pretty easy way to gain some advantage in a niche.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been doing more and more with schema at the moment. Like mostly it's still at the testing phase. So I've been doing things like adding like you mentioned, an address and a phone number to an about us page or a contact us page, and then building some citations. So using Matt Diggity's kind of take on actual building citations for your affiliate sites, and then actually calling out those citations in organizational schema and adding it. That organizational schema to the page. So you tell Google, these are our citations. And similar for the social media profiles, but marking it up with person schema. I mean, I've only done this in the last couple of weeks, so it's still, I don't know what the results are yet. So far, nothing. No real major changes, but I think Schema is, I'm bullish on Schema. Any kind of way you can present data to Google or almost on a silver platter, I think is worth doing.
That's exactly it. Good point. I like that.
Yeah. Okay. The other thing I want to touch on, I've never done anything with this, is web stories. I know you mentioned that you added a web story. I can see it on the site. How did that work? Have you done more of this? Like, did it work?
Not really. Yeah, it was a test. I wanted to see the process, so I went through it. It's really labor intensive, unless you have like a graphic design team at your disposal. Yeah. And then I was reading, I got no results, like nothing. It was a total waste of time, but I want to try it. And then I was reading that Google was saying, like, if you have a published article on the site, like, don't do a web story on. The web story should be a standalone piece of content, and there shouldn't be like the equivalent blog article on that.
Okay.
And I'm like, oh, wow. I mean, I don't know. Web stories, they might show up in Discover, mm-hmm. which is Google's mobile app for content. But then I'm like, I don't know. I think I just prefer to just have the blog on it. My thinking behind it initially was, well, I'll turn a lot of my content where it makes sense into web stories and maybe gain an advantage on mobile.
Yeah.
But then I read, well, you're not supposed to do that. So that whole thinking kind of didn't work out. They're really labor intensive because you're creating these, like, basically these pieces of content in like with JPEGs or, yeah. you know, or they have their own editor, but it's like, I don't know. It's a lot of work. So that's as far as I got. If anybody else has had great success with it, I'd love to hear where you're getting the traffic and whether you're able to crank them out fast.
Yeah, sounds like I'm probably going to give this a skip. I mean, it's on my list of things to test, but based on what you said there, probably pushing it down my list of things to test.
Yeah, you know, I think the idea is cool. I like the idea, like, when you actually go to a web story on, like, on mobile, it's slick, right? You just, like, slide and get this thing out. But I think it's the concept's much better if they made it so that it looked really good in content, right? So, like, you could put it at the top of a blog post, and here's the, you know, the 20-second slide version of this article. And if that would sort of give that article a boost in mobile through Google's mobile apps, that would be pretty cool. Because I do think, like, when you actually use it, when you check it out on mobile, it's pretty slick.
Yeah, agreed. And then one of the ad networks would find a way to monetize that then, and then you have ads all over it.
Of course.
Awesome. Well, we're coming towards the end now. There's only two more things I want to ask. And this one I'm going to start asking everyone because I find this topic is super interesting. But if you literally lost everything today, like, how would you start again? What's the first couple of actions you would take to start to rebuild everything? Knowing what you know now, obviously.
Yeah, probably just start looking for a niche I'm really interested in and start writing my brains out and go after really easy to rank keywords. Probably would do a little bit of link building after several months. I try not to go nuts. I think that would speed it up. But I'd see. It kind of depends on the results at that point. But I would really just go for, like, ridiculously easy keywords and just bang out as much content as humanly fast as I could.
Makes sense. It's exactly the same strategy you're doing now then, basically. just
doing, yeah, pretty much. I mean, it does work, but it does take a long time. I mean, it depends on the financial situation, but, you may have to freelance or do something as well to pay the bills, because you're not going to see money for some time.
Cool. Okay. And then the last thing is, what's the future hold both for your sites and for FatStack? So would you ever sell your sites? Would you ever consider an exit? Or is this, like, a long term, you want to build this into just keep growing and growing and growing?
Yeah, I plan to grow, but yeah, I'm going to sell them eventually, sure. At some point where it's going to make sense for me to sell. The way I look at selling stuff is it's got to serve a purpose. It's got to do something for me financially and make it worthwhile. At this point, it's not worth it, but it would have to, like, fulfill a financial goal of mine to sell it at that point. And then assess. So like the recent bunch of sites I sold, I have opportunity with those proceeds, that, and so that was specifically why I wanted to sell them right now, as well as also being able to focus more. Because I mean, I figured, well, if I'm not going to really do much with the sites at this point, I might as well, and I've got a good purpose for the proceeds. To, you know, both of those reasons together make it really good reason to sell. If I didn't have any good use of the proceeds, I'd probably just let those sites sit. So I probably would have kept them, because I mean, in a year, they're still there, they're still earning, and I could just return to them. But I had a good use for that. So yeah, my next sale for any sites would be, as long as I've got a really good use for the proceeds. That's sort of how I go about it.
Would you ever sell out of fear that something could happen with Google? Like, you know, you build these sites to such a massive revenue that you could sell, you know, for a couple of million. And then, you know, is there ever risk? Do you ever think about, I'll sell because there's risk that Google could, you know, push out another update, which could destroy your business overnight?
Yeah. I mean, you think about these things. Absolutely. I mean, it could happen. Yeah. For sure. But not quite yet. But yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know. I would also like to think, like, the bigger it gets, right? Like, even at this point, if it suffered a 40% reduction, it's still would earn a ton of money.
That's
right.
True.
So like you build these things up, because it's going to lose traffic at some point. I mean, you know, anybody who has lost traffic from an update recently, you know, I think you could take some consolation. Go plug in like the biggest sites in your niche in Ahrefs and look at their five-year traffic profile, the organic traffic profile. They have ups and downs too, and some big ones, right? And these are like the biggest sites on the web for their respective niches. So, I mean, if they're having big ups and downs, so am I. It's going to happen. So I guess part of me, the strategy is, okay, well, if we build it to such a huge level where a 40% drop is going to still result in an excellent business, you know, then I'm further insulated from any really big problems, right? So
yeah,
it's kind of my thinking now.
That's a good answer. That's a really good way of thinking about it. Maybe because I'm not at that level yet where you know, I'm not making 80 or whatever, how much ever you make in a month at the moment. That kind of level. But yeah, I like that. And plans for FatStacks? Obviously, you continue publishing. What's going on there? Any future exciting plans for that? Any new courses you've got coming out?
Well, I've started doing a lot more email marketing on my niche sites. I'm trying it. I'm getting some interesting results. So I'm thinking about an email marketing for niche sites course.
Okay.
And then also I've had a lot of requests about what I'm doing for Facebook, because I'm getting like 300,000 visitors a month from Facebook for free. So people want to know about that. That's a tricky, the email thing's easy because that's very formulaic, but Facebook's a real hit and miss sort of thing. So it's not like do this and this and this and it'll work. It's sort of like try this and sorry, but that's the best I can tell you. You know, here's what I did, and I can't tell you it's going to work. So that's what I have in the works. The Facebook one, well, people have asked me to put it out. I'll make it very clear, like, this is a total crapshoot, right? I mean, that's the best I can tell you. But that hopefully this year I'll get both of those things out.
Awesome. I bought your Pinterest course a little while back, even though I've not implemented yet. I'm one of those people that collect courses and read them and then don't act on them. I thought the content was great. Like, I understood it. I've never even used Pinterest personally before I read your course, and I looked at that and I understood it really, really well. So I just want to say hats off. And I saw your recent post. Have you almost just crossed 500,000 in sales, course sales?
Yeah, quite a bit beyond that, I think. Yeah,
I saw that post. I was like, that's insane. So that's huge. Congratulations, man. Your courses are really, really good.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Cool. Anything else you think our audience might be interested in knowing about you, or kind of anything you think that we might have missed as we've gone through everything today?
Got to say, you're thorough. not very much. That's about what I do. My site is fatstacksblog.com. Check it out if you want. That's where I just sort of write about what I'm doing.
Yeah, I'd highly recommend it. And I'd highly recommend you jump on John's newsletter. You don't have a set schedule, right? I get emails from you kind of randomly.
I'm consistent with my complete disorganization. I do not have a publishing schedule for anything ever. I don't have a schedule. In fact, this is the first thing that's been on my calendar for a long, long time. This interview with you. No, I don't schedule anything. I just make it up each day when I show up. I don't know if there'll be a newsletter or not.
Well, I enjoy them. I enjoy newsletters. So anybody who's listened to this and is not on John's newsletter, then I'd recommend it.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Awesome. Well, thanks for your time, John. I really appreciate it. I appreciate your time and all the advice you've given. I think our listeners and audience will find this super interesting. So thanks again.
Thank you, Adam. It's fun.
Cheers. Bye, John.
Thanks again for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed the show. If you're listening to the podcast version of this episode, please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Please rate and review, as this will allow us to grow our audience and create more shows like this one. If you're watching on YouTube, please subscribe to the channel and click on the bell to be the first to know about any new episodes that we release. Until the next episode, goodbye.